This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Hey guys, and welcome to Personality Bingo with me, your host, Tom Moran. So this week on the podcast, we have the amazing Dylan Coburn Gray. Dylan is a writer and a performance poet based in Dublin. His first three plays were with the Dublin Youth Theatre, and you're probably going to best know him from his smash hit play Boys and Girls, as well as that Black Catfish, Musketeer, Love Plus, Everything Not Saved. So much wonderful work. He's also worked as a director, a dramaturg, a deviser. He's done music for stuff. I mean, he really does it all. And what a gentleman he was. I think me and Dylan, it's fair to say, we're like kind of peripherally aware of each other. So it was so nice to sit down and have the chats here at Headstuff HQ. And my God, is he not the most kind, intelligent and just lovely person? So Dylan, if you're listening, a massive thank you to you for taking the time to do it. It was a pleasure to meet you, and I can't wait to see you about the place soon. Guys, in other news, my play The Belly Button Girl is coming back to the New Theatre. It's running from May 14th to the 19th, so go and check that out. If you like this podcast, I think you like the play. They're kind of all coming from the same place in my heart, I think. Oh, that was very earnest to say, but fuck it, it's true. So come and check that out. Support Irish Theatre, I guess. That was very earnest too, but sure, look, we all know what we're dealing with here. Come and check us out. We've got a great team involved. Romana Testaseca directing, Owen Lennon on the lights, and the wonderful Ursula McGinn is doing our set. So look, we're surrounded by great company, and I think when you do that, great things can possibly happen. So come and check us out. I'd really appreciate it. As well as that, Copperface Jackson musical is coming back. It's very, very exciting. Probably the most enjoyable show I've ever done, truth be told. We just had the best time doing it. It's by the brilliant Paul Howard, who you'll know from the Ross O'Carroll Kelly book series and tons of other stuff. It's got a great cast, including Johnny Ward, Michelle McGrath, Rosanna Purcell, Stephen O'Leary, Mark Fitzgerald. Ah, I could go on all day, but I won't, because I'm afraid I'm going to leave out just one person, and that would be shameful. As well as that, I've got some stand-up dates coming up soon in Dublin City Centre. Catch me at Bingo Loco as well, where I am a kind of resident host comedian there. Really enjoying all of that, and it's a lovely time. The weather's getting great in Dublin, and thanks so much for all your support of the podcast. It's kind of going from strength to strength at the moment, and I'm not sure why, it just is, which is lovely. We have a Patreon page. It's patreon.com/personalitybingo. Go and check it out. We've got some brilliant rewards there for people who can chip in our way. As little as $2 a month makes a huge difference to us. I know that sounds like bullshit. I promise you it's not. It's a model based off soundness. I see our numbers that come in here every week. Even if like a handful of you are able to chip something our way, it just covers those costs that do rack up when you're doing this for as long as we have, which is about 120 odd episodes, which is insane. So guys, thanks so much for all your support. It's so appreciated, and I genuinely it means the world that you take time out of your day to listen to the wonderful people that I've managed to get on this podcast. So without further ado, here's another one. Enjoy the wonderful Dylan Coburn Gray playing Personality Bingo with Tom Moran. Dylan Coburn Gray, ready to play Personality Bingo?
Here we go.
All right, sweet. So a quick explanation of how it all works. I've got 60 minutes on the clock. I've got 60 balls in here, and I've got 60 corresponding questions. I've also given you a sheet of paper with five numbers on it. Would you do me a favour and read out the five?
Okay, I have 9, yep. 17, right. 53, okay. 41, yep. A blank space, baby, and I'll write your name, and a 38.
Nice. Okay, was that a song reference that I didn't get?
Taylor Swift.
Okay, sweet, well done.
Blank space.
I'm terrible at references.
It's really good.
Is it?
Yeah.
I'm so bad at references.
Okay.
And it's very alienating for people when I don't get their references, because they feel shit, but like I'm the one that should carry the shame for this moment.
I mean, I feel like particularly in the case of Tay-Tay. I mean, that's on you.
T-Swift.
That's on you.
I will take that. Okay, do me another favour and fill in that blank baby or whatever that obscure reference was.
That lad. Okay, I'm going to put in 27.
27. Any reason?
It's my age.
Okay, sweet.
Yeah.
Good a reason as any. And I should say that if all six of them numbers do come out, that means the tables are turned. You get to ask me any question in the whole wide world. I'll give you a totally honest answer.
Okay.
All right. Sweet. Exciting. So let's give it a spin.
Cool.
All right, here we go. First out the gate, we have number 9. Do you have it?
I do.
Oh.
Right off the bat.
Yes. Okay. Starting to sweat a little in here. All right. Number 9. Do you have a favourite quote?
Oh, God. Yes. Mm. I have a couple. I have different favourites for different contexts.
Yeah, that's okay. We can take a few. I like a good quote. So,
yeah. So I'm a huge Michael Ondaatje fan. I think that's how you say his name. You know, the kind of Sri Lankan Canadian author who wrote The English Patient.
Okay.
Which then was that film. But it's kind of a weird one because his books are very formal in the sense that, you know, like there's all of these hard cuts from location to location and the prose is as much a feature as what's actually happening and everything. And that's kind of the first thing that goes when you turn one of his books into a film.
Sure.
So I was always a little weirded out before I'd seen the film. Actually, no, I still haven't seen the film. I think I just tell myself I have because there's always like romantic clips of it playing on things when they talk about how it won an Oscar. But anyway, his writing's beautiful. It's incredible. And there's a couple from him. You know, he has a really beautiful poem called The Cinnamon Peeler's Wife, which people read a lot at weddings, which has something at the end I can't actually remember, but is, yeah, that's a great wedding quote. I think my favourite book by him is a book called In the Skin of a Lion, which is kind of about the immigrants who built Toronto. And there's an amazing moment in it where he's just kind of meditating on the fact that, like, he's writing a book and he says, the first line of every novel should be, there is an order here, very faint, very human, it takes time, something, 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 something like that. Which I just think is a really great little kind of, I don't know, bracket quote for the whole artistic endeavour of, like, making shit up as you go along and hoping people enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I kind of had a vague thought of, like, I'm not mad on text tattoos, but if I was ever going to get a text tattoo, that it might be very faint, very human. And then someone pointed out that that kind of sounds, without the context, like a dog meme. You know, like a dog being like, oh, very faint, much human. And I'm like, oh, fuck, that's so true.
Wow. Yeah, because it's like you've told a joke without the punchline.
Yeah, pretty much. But like, he's a quote factory. I mean, he has another beautiful little poem called I can't remember what it's called. But anyway, the closing line is, it's just about his friends and visiting his friends. And I suppose in midlife, as they see each other less. But the closing line is, I don't know what to say about this kind of love, but I refuse to lose it. Which is like, oofed.
Yeah.
Go on, Michael.
That first quote, does that resonate with you in terms of your own artistic process? I'll frame it selfishly. So I've written plays. I'm also really interested in writing for film and TV as well. Mm. And so at the moment, which is something that I find less of a need to do in my theatre writing, I feel, but more of a need to do in the more for the screen stuff is to outline a little bit more.
Yeah.
It just feels like it needs a little bit more structure for me. But I don't work well within like a rigid structure, but something. What's your relationship to structure and pre-planning when you're writing yourself?
Ooh. I'm resisting the urge to say good question because Claire O'Reilly keeps slagging me off for that because it's a way of buying yourself 3 seconds without sounding like you're hesitating. But that is a good question. I'm very structurally minded. I really like structures and thinking about kind of the form of a play and having fun with that. Mm. Equally, I'm not big into like 3-act structure and, you know, kind of that very rising action, you know, inciting incident, always save the cat type model. Because I think, I don't know, I kind of feel like very often, I mean, you know, you've definitely watched a film where you've watched it and been more conscious of the structure than invested in what was actually going on, do you know?
Yeah, I mean,
I think we've all had that moment. I think kind of sometimes that structure upstages anything you try to do with it because it's been so repeated. But I haven't written much for TV, so I haven't had to do that as much. And yeah, I don't know, maybe I'm starting to find it a little funny maybe in terms of the conversations in the UK sometimes where people kind of talk about my writing as, oh, it's lyricism. And you go, you don't understand. Like, I'm a Lego nerd, which is like, I'm thinking about what colour the blocks are and putting them in this order and then reversing the order of the colours and this, that and the other. So it is just, I suppose, interesting to be really obsessed with structure and then have nobody realise there is a structure there. Yeah. Paradoxically. Is that an answer?
Yeah, it is. I'm interested. So when you're in the UK and they're talking about this lyricism, what... If someone said that to me about my writing, I wouldn't actually know what they meant. Do you know what they mean?
Oh, I mean, I absolutely know what they mean, which is it's that cliche of Irish writers as like these passive wankers who like kind of sit around, you know, kind of endlessly describing with beautiful, you know, kind of mellifluous words, you know, their situation that they're fundamentally powerless to change. And again, I kind of feel there's a historical irony in being told off for that because it's like, well, if we all think for like 30 seconds... We might come up with some reasons why a colonized people feel like they lack meaningful agency to, you know, transform their circumstances,
right.
Do you know,
yeah.
type thing. So, I mean, I don't think it's just an aesthetic preference. I think it's, and I mean, like on a really concrete level, it's the monologue play thing, you know, which is like, oh, Irish writers love monologues. And you go, no, we can only afford to write monologues because personnel, you know, like actors are really expensive. You don't want to ask your mates to work for free. And then you do anyway.
Yeah. Exactly. But at least then they get loads of lines.
Yeah.
Right. Love it. Okay, let's give it a spin.
Yeah, let's go.
All right, here we go. Number 46. Do you have it?
I do not.
No worries. Number 46. Do you believe in an afterlife?
No. I was raised secularly. I think kind of, I don't know, like I think we're the first generation to really get that.
Mm.
And so yeah, don't believe in anything, and try to kind of keep that quiet because I think sometimes it can feel like quite an aggressive thing to say to people you don't believe in anything, as though there's an implicit thing there of whatever you do believe is hoop.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting, and I'm sure even within your own secularism, like the statement like I don't believe in anything is a stark statement and, yeah. and probably not representative. Well, I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but not necessarily representative of what a lot of secularists or atheists or whatever it might be believe. Like, I'm sure you believe in loads of things, but just not like what was so fundamental to the way our, my parents and my grandparents and probably most of ours grew up within, you know, which is like the framework of the Catholic Church and like
I mean, sorry, I mean, I'm aware that's like kind of a deliberately bolshy way of phrasing it, but it is clear because very often, you know, there is that conversation you have with your mates, you know, around drink too, which is a thing of, you know, like, oh well, obviously I'm not Catholic, but I know there's something, or I saw a ghost, or this, that, and the other, and all of which I think is so interesting. But I have never done any of those things.
Yeah,
I've never seen a ghost.
Yeah,
I've never felt someone was talking to me from the other side. But then I've never really lost anyone, so I don't think. There's anyone on the other side who would prioritize talking to me, so it might just be that.
Sure, yeah. If they have like the genie in the lamp of like three wishes, you're not there, man. Like,
yeah.
What about so that's really interesting. Okay, I'm really interested in ghosts. Okay. I actually was talking to someone the other day about this. I keep having like work meetings with like I signed with a new agent recently, and we had a meeting, and like for the first. Like 45 minutes of it, we just talked about ghosts, and like we didn't really talk enough about work, but it was kind of the best meeting because like that was the point. Like it was great that we connected about that. But so, right, if you're in a context that would be like traditionally horror movie scary, like I don't know, a rural old house in the dark, the power goes. Are you like, do you feel fear of something in that scenario? I know it's very hypothetical.
Oh yeah. I mean, like I was up in Anna McCarrig earlier this year. In November, and you do get that thing of, because like old houses do just make noises.
Yeah.
So whatever about what I believe, you know, like I think kind of your the hairs on the back of your neck believe their own. They have their own elaborate thing worked out.
And so when you're like in that scenario and you're like, yeah, this is a bit spooky, like what if you go the level deeper of like what you're afraid will happen or what you're afraid you'll see or what you're afraid that reality might be, what is it?
Oh, well, like I'm a very jumpy person. So I mean, I think I don't even need a ghost. I literally just need there to be someone in the room who I haven't spotted and I'll freak the fuck out.
Yeah.
And also like particular to that house is the fact that I think the second last time I was there, there was this older Australian woman who kind of I think decided if she got through her week's residency without having someone, it would be a missed opportunity. And so she worked her way down the list of the eligible men until she got to me, and I think kind of she'd drunk half a bottle of whiskey one night or something, and kind of found myself in this really bizarre situation of having like this woman, you know, kind of massaging my shoulders, but like sticking her hands down like into my shirt and kind of like tweaking my nipples at the dinner table in front of a group of people, all of whom assumed I was into it in that weird way of like, I mean, if you're a man, you're obviously into everything or sure. whatever. So they left us alone. And I had to kind of find a way to like very, I suppose, tactfully fend her off. But like she was so fucked, she couldn't get to bed. So I had to bring her up to her room then, I think, in that weird complex way of like, oh, I'm having to look after you, even though you're making me really profoundly uncomfortable. And then she tried to pull me into the room on the doorstep. And I literally had to go, oh, look, and make her look over her own shoulder into the room and then fucking run down the corridor to my room. And luckily, she didn't know which room I was in, but I heard her walking up and down looking for me for the next 5-10 minutes. And so, I tell that as a funny story because, like, I think, okay, so gender flip that. It's a terrifying story of, like, grotesque sexual assault. Yep. But I didn't feel particularly unsafe, which is the key thing. Mm-hmm. And I think the key differential maybe sometimes when you do gender flip, I suppose, that traditional dynamic or whatever. But what I would say is in that particular house late at night, that's what I would be afraid of.
Yeah. Well,
is hearing someone walk, hearing the scary Australian woman walking up down the corridor outside going, Dylan, Dylan. Again.
I've not been to Annamacarrick, but I feel like I've definitely, someone who's been was telling me like that is like, you know, one of the haunted places.
Oh yeah, no, like, and the ghost has a Twitter account.
Really?
Yeah.
I need to give that a follow.
Oh yeah.
What?
Miss Warby. And again, like, I mean, you know, just leaning into that or steering into the skid of that story a little more, because that is a sideways thing to have thrown in there. Like the ghost is quite sexually threatening as well. Like there's a weird dynamic to that house as well. Like, I mean, the first time I was up there, the ghost tweeted at me, yeah, I'm going to slip into your bed tonight, which again, I was like, OK, you know, funny joke, cause I'm a man. I also don't love that, do you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold on. Okay, sorry. So there's a Twitter account.
The ghost has a Twitter account.
So, okay, so can I, stop me whenever I say here the wrong go. Thing. So someone who works in Annamacarrick has made a Twitter account on behalf of this ghost that people have told stories about for years. And now that they tweet the people who they know are in residence at the guest, so it we assume it's one of the staff?
I mean, if you're asking me, the person who believes in nothing... Yes, that's what's happening. Alternatively, the ghost has a Twitter account. You know, I mean, let's keep our minds open, you know, to the full field of possibilities.
How big is the staff at Annamacarrick, would you reckon?
Oh, God, like, it's a brilliant bunch of them. You haven't been?
I haven't been.
Ah, get up there.
Yeah.
Because if you're right, I mean, like, it's just...
Yeah.
It's unreal. Yeah. Because, you know, it's just, they do the meals. You don't have to do your laundry because, you know, you've just brought all your clothes. So, like, you can't go off sideways into stuff.
Amazing.
That makes you feel productive, but doesn't actually advance your work.
Yeah.
I think there's like 8 of them, maybe. Okay. Between the kitchen and the office and the Robbie and the, they're brilliant.
Yeah.
And they look after you really well, and they really care.
Yeah. And then they just fuck with you on Twitter.
Well, I mean, the other possibility maybe is I think that like it's an artist who thinks it's gas, and they find out who's going up, and then if there's a mate there, because I mean. On that basis, I think it's probably a theatre head because they felt like safe being like, ha 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 ha, weird, sexually teasy joke towards Dylan. He's up for it.
Yeah, gassed. That is fascinating.
It's a great mystery.
Yeah, I love that. All right. Let's give it a spin. So, number 29, do you have it?
I do not.
No worries. When you think about your childhood, what's your most clear memory?
Really embarrassingly, I remember quite a lot of my childhood via what books I was reading when.
Well,
because I think unsurprisingly, to anyone who knows me or has seen my plays or whatever, which is I read a lot. I'm a big book nerd. So I have this really vivid memory of reading Robin Hobb's Farseer trilogy on a family holiday in Dingle. And now every time I'm in Dingle, I'm just kind of like, oh, I think around here, I was probably around page 600 where the fool is doing that thing and Burke is kind of coming across for the sea to, you know, like the out islands and, which is nerdy and pathetic and all those things.
Yeah.
Because it's like, why would you pay attention to your real life when you've got this, you know, fantasy adventure alongside?
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about that, like the why... like, you know, because I was saying to you off mic, I was like, I traditionally haven't been a big reader, but it's something that I'm getting into now, and I'm really seeing the joy of it. And I'm also seeing how actually this will fundamentally make me a better writer.
Yeah.
Even though right now I don't have a great grasp to, like, you know, go after a novel or anything like that. I just don't feel like I maybe have anything to add to that conversation right now. But I can, like, what seeing other people's craft in the page is just has to be good for you, right? So do you, and when I think about me and my writing, I think I have an idea why writing is appealing to me, and there's loads of reasons and it's layered and I enjoy it, but I, you know, like on a psychological level, I bet there's a good reason. Do you ever think about that for yourself within the context of reading, and like, or was it just a pure like joy thing, or is there that element of like, not to go down the well-trodden path of escapism or something like that?
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, the really honest answer, and I was kind of chatting about this recently to a writer pal who finds writing quite difficult. They don't enjoy it. They really enjoy having written plays, like in retrospect. Oh, I'm really glad I did that. But they don't enjoy like the actual work of sitting down and going tappity-tappity-tap, which I do. And I sometimes feel like a little unusual in that I'm a writer who really, really, really likes writing. I think more of my peers find it a really angsty process than don't. And like, for example, like when I did the 24-hour plays, I was in a room with Kate Heffernan and Rashi Goan, and I just was having these school flashbacks to pretending not to have done my homework in order to fit in because I had finished my play. And Kate and Rashi were there going, oh, it's so hard, it's so hard, it's so hard. And I was, I'm having a great time. I'm finished.
Yeah.
And then because Kate's a pal, like she caught me rapid, you know, like, which is, I had finished. And she went, you're finished, aren't you? And I went, yeah. But no, when I was chatting to this pal, and I think what I said was, because they're really funny and they're really socially graceful, and I'm a bit weird. And I think sometimes maybe the appeal of reading, and then by extension writing, if you're a bit weird, is that it's a small, controllable world. You know, which is, it's a world where you understand every element, or there is the potential to understand every element, because every element is deliberate and isn't just random and coming at you all the time, like the real world. And that then I think maybe that's the appeal of, or maybe why I like writing is because for me, I generally feel like my writing is a more polished, in control version of my social self. Whereas I think if you are a very socially powerful person anyway, you are very exacting on your writing for exactly that reason, which is that... it has to be as good as you in person.
Oh.
That makes sense?
Yeah, it does.
Sorry, that was quite a circuitous. But yeah, I don't know. Where do you feel? Does that resonate with you or anything? Or?
Well, it's really interesting. I think so. Like, I would imagine, you know, an outsider might describe me as being socially graceful. I would be fine. I have absolute, like, my anxieties about social situations. I also can do them quite well. I really have realised I'm in a really privileged position at the moment of living by myself, which really suits me. And it's come about in an unfortunate way in many ways. But my lovely grandmother passed away in September. So that the house is in the process of being sold, which is quite slow. So I'm kind of like looking after it. And it coincided with my rent in town being up. And so it kind of made sense for me. So I'm living in Castleknock in a weird, scary, old haunted house.
Okay,
as far as I'm concerned. So this is all in my zeitgeist.
Yeah.
And but it's one of the things I realise I really like. And it really suits me creatively. And I kind of knew that because I haven't been to Anna McCarrick, but I would kind of go on self-imposed, like, you know, Airbnb, you know, retreats and things. And that, like, solitude is really important for me. And I think one of the ways I really, writing for me can be, like, just, I don't write particularly autobiographically, but it always comes from, like, a feeling or a thing that is probably very real to me. And it's a nice way for me to kind of rewrite the real narrative of my life. I feel like that, so, like, that element of control, absolutely. There's also an element of like the lone wolfiness of it that is very appealing to me. Like for the first time I applied with a pal to write something with them, and while it was really exciting, we were sitting down and like kind of brainstorming a little bit, and we're like, I'm interested in this part, and she's like, well, I'm not interested in that, but what about this? And we're, you know, we're finding we're finding where we match and where we don't. And then I could also, like, I can already like imagine the own anxieties and fears about that, because, you know, and what I wanted to ask you, maybe to bring it back to you for a moment, is about you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you have written plays where you're not involved in a role other than the writer, but you've also performed it in your own work as well.
And I have.
The poetry work.
That, yeah.
So what's the difference when you're sitting down with the intention of, like, this is going to be for me, Dylan, to, like, perform to the world, whether in a theatrical context or a poetry context, mm-hmm. versus, say, a project like City Song, which we spoke about at the beginning of the show? It sounded like it's one of the ones where you've been able to, you don't really have a job aside from writing it.
Yeah. I mean, even bouncing off the end of what you were saying there about collaboration, because the other thing I do is I'm with Malaprop, so I write a lot with them. So there's these kind of three strands of the stuff I'm writing for me, the stuff I write on my own for other people, and the stuff I write with other people for other people. Mm. And I think, like you were saying, that finding out what you're all interested in is a key part of the process. And I think I feel like there's a really natural kind of permeable boundary between the two, because writing is a process of finding out what you're interested in, and then you just extrapolate that to everybody else when you're collaborating, you know, because I don't feel much pressure, or I try not to feel much pressure to know what things are about or what the thought is going in. I think, I feel like the value of writing, like you say, is sometimes the process of discovery, mm-hmm. of working out why this thing kind of tickles or itches, or, do you know?
Mm-hmm.
You have to orbit it. What is the difference? I mean, I think the really practical, boring one is I can be more inconsiderate when I'm writing for myself, because I can write things that are as dense as I want them to be. In the poetry sense, you know, kind of like really, really tightly rhymed or whatever, and I don't have to worry about someone else, or not even someone else being able to do it, but it being, you know, reasonable to ask someone else to do it, because, you know, I think, you know, some of the fun of poetry is, you know, complexity for complexity's sake, and then having things come back into focus after, you know, kind of a weird little sideways riff. Mm. But you try to really save those effects for when you kind of need them in a play, whereas in a poem that you're going to perform yourself and you're not going to be inflicting it on someone else. Because you were saying, I think, off mic, you know, just that City Song is casting at the moment. And that's been really interesting, because it's just, I sat in for a little bit of the process. It's been really interesting, I think, to remind yourself that reading's a really stressful thing for loads of people, because I love it.
Mm.
And I mean, I think my style is very much like written for people who read as fast as I do. And actually then you miss out, I suppose, on seeing loads of really fucking talented actors at their peak, because, you know, they're best on their feet, you know, and that it's just good to be reminded to step outside your own taste and your own little weird niche that you've carved or whatever for a little bit, because there were people who were incredible and doing incredible stuff on that floor. And it's just, I don't know, like, I appreciate from the other end that, you know, auditions are horrible, but like, I've never been produced before, so it is just such a privilege to get to meet all these actors and kind of chat through, because, you know, I don't know, we live in a city that's full of really fucking talented people, and I'd love to work with all of them, and you just never get a chance to. So
sure.
It's amazing that way. And anyway, ramble.
Yeah, what was it like being on that side of the table and seeing people come in and interpret your work? Like, is it, as you said, all the positives of it, like meeting these people? And I'm sure, you know, when I've shared work with people, and I'm sure you've had this experience where someone illuminates something that, not even that it wasn't what you meant, but maybe you weren't aware of it. And it's just when someone shines a light in it through their personality, their talent, whatever it might be, you're kind of like, whoa, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally speaking, that's what you look for in a script, which is that when you hand it to actors, you go, oh, that's what it's about.
Right.
You know, that's their job. That's not your job, you know. And I think it's really lovely to have, you know, kind of ongoing collaborators. And then there is just that excitement of seeing new people, because they surprise you more. And I think when it's a good relationship, they continue to surprise you. But either way, you know, like, that initial surprise is a really gorgeous moment. And it's really good for your brain, you know, just to go, oh, this is what the writing can be. I think, again, maybe a reason I like writing is because I like thinking of a script as unfinished. You know, it's a recipe. You know, it isn't the work. The work is the thing you see on the stage at the end. Whereas, like, I know some people who really fuss over their pauses and their dashes and their brackets, you know?
Yeah.
And I suppose, like, my undergrad is in music. And I spent 3 years arguing about textual fidelity to scores and or texts and everything. And I kind of just burned out in it and kind of came away with a sense of, oh my God, I just don't fucking care. And I kind of think actors really bring that home for me, that, like, they're an exciting bunch.
Sure. Do you ever find that the musicality, your musical background ever again, this is a selfish question. All the questions are selfish. Just to
say
that. do you ever find that the musicality that is obviously within you, having studied music, whatever that might be, ever controls the way you write? Like, are you, when you're reading it back or you're writing, you're either reading it back to yourself out loud or the voices in your head, whatever it might be, like, do you really go sometimes I find myself really going for like this rhythmic thing and I'm like, like, this is fun for me and this feels like I'm like untangling like a piece of knot in a really satisfying way, but I'm not sure how much it's like serving and how much it's actually gonna land.
Yeah. Rhythm's a really funny one because it's really powerful, but it is also lulling. And Katrina, who's directing City Song, I think is really wise to that. And she's really good at shocking actors who are, I think, getting into the groove a little too much, where you're kind of, I think, you're enjoying the rhythm at the expense of sense and it becomes a little masturbatory.
Sure.
I always feel uncomfortable saying this because it feels like potentially a more sexually aggressive thing coming from a dude. But Claire O'Reilly, my pal, very evocatively calls that deep throating the text. and it is just such a great phrase, that I do find it popping into my head, but I don't always let it out. So you try not to do that.
Yeah.
Unless it's called for, which sometimes it is. But yeah, I don't know, because I think my interest would always be rhythm's going to sort itself out. So I say you write it and then you let people ignore it because it'll do something, even if it isn't the way you imagined it. I think maybe I feel the musicality more on a structural level because I studied musicology and music is really good for getting you thinking, I suppose, about structure and how structure means because, there's a composer whose music I'm not entirely mad on, Peter Maxwell Davis, but he has this great soundbite about how there's no melody so beautiful, you can't fuck it up in execution, which is, this sounds brilliant, like if played by, kind of a plaintive violin in this register. If you put it on a trombone, it sounds comical, in fundamentally. And I think that really translates to playwriting and storytelling so well, which is there is no story so interesting you can't fuck it up by having a really ham-fisted bit of exposition, by having a really narmy monologue that you can't fuck up by having, a really shit bit of acting, So at a certain point, it comes down to how you put those elements together to make sure they end up more than the sum of their parts. And that's a really freeing, I think first principles approach to structure. And another one of my lecturers had a great soundbite, which is like my version of three act structure in terms of transformation, which is just, there isn't a structure, but the golden rule is that every new element you introduce should make you think differently about every element you've already experienced.
Okay.
Yeah.
Say that to me one more time.
So every new element you introduce should make you think differently about every element you've already encountered. And that's exposition, which is, that's the thing of, you're supposed to find out stuff along the route of a story that makes you feel differently about these people, and there's a really crude version of that, which is like the bad twist ending, which is they were all ghosts. Spoiler.
Yeah.
And then you have to retroactively look back and reinterpret everything you've just watched in light of that. But that's quite a crude version, because then if you watch it again, you already know the big twist and it's probably less interesting. The really good twists are the ones where you can watch it again and it's as interesting, if not more so.
Right.
But I think on a really simple level, that's a really powerful tool because it applies to structure as well. It's like, if you're going to introduce a dance sequence, what function does the dance sequence serve, not just in and of itself, but in relation to what you've already seen, like how does it recontextualize? And and I feel like that's a really musical way of approaching writing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Have you ever directed your own work?
Yeah, but only of necessity. I'm not a director.
Okay.
I'm mentally blind. I probably shouldn't say that because I'm not. But I have very poor mental imagery.
I completely feel your pain.
Yeah. When I was in DYT with John Gunning, the lighting designer, there was a phase where he and another visual artist pal of ours used to drive me nuts because they kept saying, "But you're a words person and we're images people." And I hated that because I was like, "Fuck you, you're not inside my head. You don't know what goes on in my head." But they were so right, which is I am a words person.
Yeah.
Or I think maybe... to be really wanky about it, I'm a time person, because the thing that I think maybe poetry and music have in common is that the thing you're really working with is time and how to stretch out a thought or condense it or this, that and the other. And space is about, boom, it's all there in front of you. Parse it, you know?
Interesting.
That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. When you, this is your first time being produced.
Yeah.
What role do you have in the choice of director? Or do you have a part in that conversation?
I think that conversation happened as part of the conversation around Soho and the Abbey co-producing, and I was involved.
Yeah,
that's kind of all I really can or should say on that.
No, totally. I was just curious, as you know, it's always that interesting thing. It was kind of tied in with the question of, you know, have you directed? And you know, obviously, yeah, if you were a words person, and you know, it's that thing of like, yeah, I don't know, because as you said, you know, there's no, well, there was a lovely quote about the melody. There's no melody so beautiful that it can't be fucked up.
Yeah.
Like there's no play so good that if the team, like, there's so many elements that need to come together for any collaboration in any medium, but like theatre especially, you know, like if it's always such an interesting thing because I haven't been produced either. So there's a real loveliness in that you have a degree of control because, you know, you are sitting in that place where, you know, you were talking about it earlier. Like, there's loads of favours needed to be asked and, like, you're getting people on board being like, you know, do you believe in this thing? Do our thoughts match about what it looks like? But when you go to that other level, obviously, like, there's the resources are greater, I assume, but also sometimes in that, like, I imagine that you could get lost or the feeling of being lost.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, to spin off on a thing that's going to initially be about trauma and then about the industry is, do you know that thing they say, which is the problem with trauma isn't that it feels bad, it's that it feels normal.
Right.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that.
Early trauma.
Yeah.
You know, so the whole point is that it throws all of your criteria of normality out of whack.
Right.
So that even if you grow up knowing your parents are alcoholics, and that, you know, 15 pints is too many pints to have of a night, you don't automatically, because you know that's wrong, know what is a healthy amount. Do you know? Mm-hmm. You might still think it's totally normal to drink every night, and because you're drinking 8 pints a night, you know, compared to 15, you know, that's half. So that's basically fine, right? You know, which is, you lack a criteria of normality, you know, which is your parents are your moral compass in the sense that if they're at the South Pole, you know, to steer north or whatever. But and I think maybe that's, and the real tragedy sometimes of that is that, like, when you encounter health, it feels unhealthy to you. And now to make that about being produced, in the sense that, like, the way the industry is, you have to do everything yourself. You have to write, you have to direct, you have to produce, you have to send all the emails, you have to try and get the press in. And that, you know, like, is a real shame, because I think more people would have more success younger if they actually just got to focus on the thing that is their talent rather than having to drag up all of these kind of ancillary epi skills alongside them, do you know? Mm-hmm. I feel like lots of people at 21 are already the writer they're going to be. You know, they have the clarity, they have the talent, they have the vision, and they just have to wait, like, probably somewhere 5 to 10 years, really, for their admin to catch up so that they can convince funding bodies to let them be as talented as they are. And then maybe the problem is, I certainly feel, which is now for the first time that I don't have to do everything, I'm going, this feels wrong. I have internalized my oppression as a theatre maker in the sense that I go, oh, this is easy. Something must be fucked up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So yeah, I think maybe that's the real damage of, like, the model, which is it leaves you ill-equipped to do anything more healthy. So I'm trying to relax into it with moderate success. But to loop back around to directing as well, Katrina's fab. I'm really excited to work with her, and I think I'm spooking her out a little bit because I keep not having any problems with what she's doing, and she keeps, like, really proactively leaving room for me to pick fights with her, and I keep just going, nope, like, I will, but I mean, I'm just not worried. And I think that spooks her out because I think she feels like she's operating in a vacuum. You know, like, no notes is the only thing scarier than notes.
Right. Well, what about, that was really gorgeous and insightful when you were, you know, using trauma to contextualize, like, this industry.
Economic trauma.
Yeah. But is that something that I don't know, that just seemed particularly insightful to me. Is it something that you've thought about, worked through, are interested in?
Oh, yeah.
All of those?
Oh, hugely. I mean, It's funny, I'm lecturing in Trinity at the moment because I was in the second year of a PhD program, which is why I live across the road on campus. I was lecturing on three contemporary Irish plays, Heroine, The Year of Magical Wanking, and I Heart Alice Hard Eye.
Okay.
And after the second of those lectures on The Year of Magical Wanking, I had a student approach me who was British and say, so I don't mean to be rude, alarm bells already going off, and he said, but I just wondered if you could recommend any Irish writers who aren't all, and people are only going to have my voice for this, but there's a little kind of dismissive hand wave goes with this of like, ooh, sexual abuse, and ooh, addiction, and ooh, colonialism. And I went, and they said, or they went on to say, because, you know, obviously that's really important to you all. But, you know, I know all this. You know, I know all about trauma, and I know all about sexual abuse, and I know all about drugs. So it's just very old hat to me. I wondered, could you recommend anyone who doesn't do that? And you just go, oh, there's a lot to unpack there, isn't there?
Yeah.
And then very helpfully, they capped it off by saying, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm English. which was really handy, because then I just got to go, well, if I were more politically angry about this, I think I would say, yeah, you're speaking from a place of profound privilege when you say that. And they immediately shot back with them, well, it's college, everyone's privileged here. And I just said, yeah, they are. Even though I don't believe that. I said, I think that's one of those very alienating things that people say that makes you feel really lonely if you aren't really privileged in a college situation. But I did say, no, yeah, let's agree with that for the sake of it. That's one of the reasons I'm not sure I want to stay. And I've since dropped out. Yeah, I mean, I think like, sorry, that's like a little illustrative thing en route to answering your question, mm-hmm. which is, I think if you're an Irish writer, you kind of have to be interested in trauma because it's everywhere.
Right.
And I think the really interesting thing about it is, I don't know, I was reading this great book by, what's the name? Christopher Reed and Bruce Castiglia. If Memory Serves, Gay Men, the AIDS Crisis and the Promise of Queer Community or something like that. I've probably fucked up the academic subtitle because they're all really long. Mm. But he quotes this great thing in it, which is trauma is a failure of meaning. Because the whole point of trauma is that precisely you don't know how to make sense of it. Which means it doesn't necessarily feel bad. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the complexity. And the shows I'm really interested in are the ones that reckon with that. That trauma is actually about all of the stuff you don't even realise is trauma around the edge. And I think when I see bad trauma shows, it's generally speaking someone who hasn't got much trying to convince you it feels bad.
Right.
And that kind of feels to me like papering over the complexity or the real interest of it.
Mm.
That makes sense?
It does. Yeah, it's very interesting thing because like it's something in my own life I've recently... I just had a bizarre like period of time before Christmas and I've kind of spoke about it briefly on this before, so to not bore anyone who consistently listens, but I just remembered things from my childhood that I literally, you know, had forgotten.
Yeah.
Like chunks, days, hours, these mad things. And like what you said, I think that's what was so interesting to me about it was, you know, for me, it arose in just like life and having kind of a quiet lifetime, not a lot of work, kind of the end of a relationship. Things were changing. It was a transitionary time that didn't necessarily feel very good, but it kind of gave space for things to come up. And, you know, it came in a therapy session. So, I mean, like the most obvious place where it could. But, and I literally just was like, yeah. And, you know, the other day I remembered this mad thing and I explained the mad thing I didn't contextualize it as mad. I just said I remembered this thing. My therapist helpfully was like, "That's mad." Like,
yeah.
And for me, it was so not. And it's so funny because if I don't really talk about it loads with friends, but it, you know, it, on occasion, it felt right, like or helpful for me to be like, "And yeah, this thing was kind of coming up for me." And they're like, "Oh my god, that's so crazy." And for me, I'm like, okay, like
yeah.
Now I understand it might be weird, but now with that knowledge and kind of intellectually, it's starting to seep through. It still doesn't feel mad. It still just feels like that was Tuesday.
Yeah, that's so interesting because, I mean, trauma is maybe the wrong word, but like that is on, you know, like the same spectrum of phenomena in the way of like everybody always thinks what they grow up with is normal, and like, you know, a moment I'm obsessed with generally when I work with young people is what they thought of other people's houses when they went to them as kids.
Oh.
Because, you know, what you think about other people's houses tells you so much about what you think of as normal. So I made this piece with DYT 2 years ago, and I remember this kid kind of going, oh, I just remember going to my friend's house and seeing his dad light a cigarette off the toaster. And I just went, oh, that's beautiful, because it's just so clearly that's this totally unprecedented event that blew your tiny fucking mind,
yeah,
you know,
which
I think is gorgeous. And we all do that, which is, no matter how bonkers, we're like, oh, that's just what life is like, until we encounter the possibility that things might be otherwise.
Mm.
Like that resonates really a lot with me, yeah.
Mm, mm.
Because, you know, like, on a really simple level, I had a sickeningly happy childhood, but you know, my mother is a theatre maker, and my dad is a primary school teacher who, after hours, directs the school musical up in Mount Temple, and runs a dance company for boys called Company B, which is about changing attitudes to dance and masculinity, and was a mime and a clown in the 80s, which I think is how he met my mother. They met on a production of, was it The Father? Yeah, my mum was in The Father, and my father was doing a mime act at the interval. But again, you know, which is like, so like, not in any traumatic sense, but like, I grew up thinking that was what every family was like. And, you know, my mother has a shaved head, and we were vegetarians in, you know, kind of North Strand in the 90s. So, I mean, in retrospect, I'd be really fascinated to meet my pals from childhood and find out what they thought of my house when they came over, you know?
Yeah.
In exactly that way, you know, of how we don't even realise how many criteria of normal we have until they're flouted. That makes sense?
Totally.
Yeah.
Are you still friends with many of your pals from that period?
No.
Interesting. And is there a reason for that?
Yeah. I mean, because it was an... I mean, looking back, one of the things going on there is class, is the fact that, like, my parents were socially mobile, so I grew up middle class, but in, you know, a neighbourhood that at the time I think was still predominantly working class, so we were just on different tracks, even though we didn't realise it at the time.
Mm.
There were complexities there. There's also a thing of, like, we were really good friends, but then two of them moved away again, but that's not unrelated to the class thing, because that's down to precarity and living situation and having to follow the work versus being a civil servant, do you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then just, yeah, like, I don't know. I feel like even then I was on a bit of a drift away from a particular masculinity, and my two Bezzy pals weren't. So I feel like even if they had stayed, I think we'd be very different. Or we are very different people now. I hear from them every so often.
Right. And on that kind of, that tracked into a different kind of masculinity, like, what was that problematic in just that growing up sense, and kind of anything that's in any way of any other tract when you're growing up can be, you know, easy pickings for bullying or alienation or shaming, whatever that might be. Was that an experience you had?
Yeah. I mean, it's no surprise to everyone who knows me, but I've spent my whole life with people thinking I'm gay.
Right.
You know, that's not always a barrel of laughs, because the people who most feel the need to bring that to you or bring that perception of you to you are not the ones who have your best interests at heart, do you know?
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think I'm minded. I haven't minded for a good couple of years now. The only time I mind anymore is when people are really rude to my partner, Carla, because they think she's fooling herself or something, which is still very hurtful. You know yourself, the teen years are tough. Mm. If you're in any way not successfully performing like this hyper masculine affect or whatever. Colm Keegan, the poet, do you know him?
And I know of his work, yeah.
I did his podcast a little while ago, possibly on this network as well, but he's a beautiful soul. I love him. I think he's so interesting. I just think he cares about all the right things and is just lovely. But he was talking about doing poetry workshops in private schools, and he said, oh, the private schools, they're almost more fucked up. And he went, because you just meet these young men and they're all undercover. And I thought that was just a really lovely way of putting it, which is, you know, which is, it's this performance that benefits nobody. You know, it's this kind of internalized McCarthyism of just don't give anything away. Don't give anything away that shows that you are failing. which you can only do. You know, you can only fail to be as masculine as you're nominally supposed to or notionally supposed to be. Mm. Do you know?
Yeah. And the sad thing about the undercover line, which is so gorgeous and cutting, it gets to something really that nearly another word, like more words can't get to. It's like, I'm sure we all have people or even images of people in our head, and that's just like that cloak never comes off, ever. And I don't like, I would kind of straddle a couple of different worlds. Mm-hmm. It's always something that I not struggle with, like I embrace. I'm that's a privilege thing, because I really like, I've had a chameleonic kind of ability sometimes in life to, you know, I was kind of at school simultaneously, let's go for like the stereotypical group names, but like one of like the popular kids, was quite sporty, quite athletic in ways. I was also kind of like fat and like had a lot of like body shame and stuff. Also kind of was like intelligent enough and like musical and like artsy in that way. So kind of could wear a lot of different hats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's really interesting seeing now, and I would like, I've kind of made an effort, and I, you know, for me it made sense to kind of keep a foot in both camps, if that's the right phrase to describe it. But, you know, seeing, say, my more like, you know, sporty friends, and who would be just more traditionally masculine, and who would engage in you know, some of the behaviours that are brilliant, like, as in, we really bond over, like, you know, sports and like competitiveness, and like that's our way in, and I love that. And I also engage in some of the more problematic aspects of like traditional masculinity, which is, you know, misogyny and, you know, like low level homophobia. And, you know, homophobia is homophobia. And, you know, you have your moments to like, and you call that out. And then other times you're just like, I don't know. Am I like the vehicle of change for you?
There's something really complex there, because like I teach, and there is an interesting thing of like, as previously alluded to, I am not a particularly hashtag mask man. But then actually I am more masculine than I think I am. To the point where like when I'm teaching, you know, kind of teenagers or whatever, I think sometimes I can say stuff about feminism or, you know, kind of, I think just the world and society generally, that's more palatable to slightly lost, reactionary, right-leaning young men. I can say things to them that sounds more palatable than it might be coming from someone who they more readily identify as like an SJW. But then you get into that really interesting territory of like, how much can you nod along to before you just have to go, no, that's fucking hoop. You know, it's like, right, yeah. No, that's just not true. But then again, you know, most of the time that doesn't come up, because I think the deep irony of that whole version of like very knee-jerky young masculinity now is that like, it's not very rigorous. It is very emotionally reactive. And the big irony being that that emotional reactivity is what leads them to say things like, facts don't care about your feelings, do you know?
Right.
Because it's looking for some solid ground in a world where they feel very lost, you know, which is, oh, well, facts, I can stick to facts. And it's why you have this kind of talismanic, you know, kind of value attached to things like free speech. And, you know, like I was working with students up in Inchicore a couple of years ago, and I was just really struck because they wanted to make a piece about polarization. And then they put up this improv, which was just like a shouty debate. And I was really struck by the number of them who talked about their First Amendment right to free speech. And then other ones who talked about their right to bear arms. And I just had to be like, oh, bud, I hate to break it to you. You know, it's like you don't live in America. You know, it's like you clearly just live off American media, and you live off American kind of shock jockey, you know, talking points. You know, it's like, I can see your YouTube recommended sidebar based on how you talk about these issues. And you live in a different country. You live in a country where we have blasphemy law, you know? Free speech is extremely curtailed in this country. And whether or not you think that's a good thing, it's just, you've just assembled a worldview from the things that feel right to you without any kind of real, I suppose, underlying logic as to how they fit together.
Mm.
Sorry, yeah. Is that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, and it was something you spoke about earlier. Maybe it was, yeah, it's kind of come up a few times in different ways, but like, what's your identity to being Irish?
Layered.
Mm.
So, I was struck by something you were saying about chameleonicism.
Yeah, I definitely made up a word, but I kind of.
Being
just
chameleonic. well, just my grandfather was Chinese.
Right.
And my mother was adopted into a white family. I say Chinese, we don't actually know that for sure, mm-hmm. because that's the best guess of my biological grandmother, who is a white woman from Waterford. So he could be from fucking anywhere. racial sensitivity not being at an all-time high in the mid-60s in Walkinstown, I think. Okay. We're not particularly close. So that's kind of a layered journey, really, in the fact that like I'm quite white-passing. If I'm with my mother, we both tend to get clocked a lot more. I won this playwriting bursary, the Phelan Donlan Award, 2 years ago. And at the ceremony, the photographer who, in fairness to him, English wasn't his first language, but he's taken a photo of me and Veronica. And halfway through the photo shoot, he paused to say, what, please, in your bloodline is suspicious. Which is just one of those interesting low-grade things that happens fairly constantly, you know, which is... and again, like, I don't think it's particularly that people are looking at me and seeing a non-white man. I think what they're looking at me is seeing a failure to be a particular Irish masculine archetype because I don't have curly hair, because I don't have hair, and I don't have blue eyes, you know? There's just complexities, I think, sometimes in having at least one invisible identity. I sometimes jokingly call myself Mr. Passing, you know?
Okay.
I feel very undercover. So... in Irishness, amongst other things.
Mm.
Partly because, you know, like I said again, you know, I was raised by hippies, so I don't find any of like the hashtag relatable banter about fries and Catholicism relatable, because that's just not my life. You know, that's never been my life. And then beyond that, I think there's a really weird undercurrent to that, which is this kind of still very hegemonic, very white version of Irishness, which doesn't allow for the fact that like actually you can be Yoruba and Irish. I wrote this play as part of Home Theatre in Dublin 15 a little while ago for a Nigerian Irish family, and that was fascinating just to see how all of those, I suppose, standard tropes existed alongside a totally different cultural upbringing. And like, I'm really obsessed with African Irish Twitter because it's just a little window into this whole other world which is as validly Irish as any other. Is that an answer?
Yeah, it is. It is. And then when like it's interesting when that conversation with the English student is going on and
yeah,
and like, I don't know, I was just really struck by maybe this is going back to the trauma thing. Maybe when I think of Irish writers or I think of Irish theatre, and I mean that's the thing that we have in common, so maybe that's why I'm focusing on it.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe, and it's so weird because when I think about the things that I've written about, I guess they are trauma, maybe low level trauma, but there's like trauma does underlie so much. Like, how fundamental do you think that is to the Irish experience and your experience of Irishness?
Oh, like, I mean, deeply fundamental. That's kind of a tautology, but I mean, I was chatting to Jill Greer, who's working at where isn't she working in London, you know, like, who's doing Vaults.
Yeah.
And she reads The National, and now she's working with Clean Break as a creative associate. So Jill's Brill. And because she reads so many plays, I think recently she was a little burnt out on Irish sesh plays. And she was asking me, as someone who wrote, you know, kind of a play in that genre, she was like, what is the fucking obsession with, you know, like the play across the night out? And in particular, what is the fucking obsession, you know, for young Irish men with plays about getting off your face? And there's layers. And I think one of them is drama, in the sense of, I think, as a generation, when you're so systematically disenfranchised that all you really know how to do is sesh, is that there's a lurking subtext there, which is you don't know how to do anything else, and that when health comes along, it doesn't feel healthy.
Mm.
You know, so it is easier just to keep sessioning than to learn how to be something else.
Mm.
You see that setting in as well, you know, and it is quite bleak. I went to a very drugsy school and wasn't particularly cool. I had friends who were much cooler than I was, like you were saying yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that awful thing of the person who's really fucking cool at 19 because they know they've got all the hookups is not the coolest person at 27 if they're still doing exactly what they were doing when they were 19. Do you know?
Yeah.
There is an arrested development built into that.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever else your mileage is on this, that or the other. But and then the other layer, I think, was the fact that, like, I think there's a real emotional constipation to the sesh play, which is the sense that the only reason you can ever own to having a feeling is if it comes from outside, you know, which is feelings are something the world does to you in the form of substances.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's a way of talking about your feelings, but without ever having to own them. That makes sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So So the it's I'm really interested in this. Yeah. So it's the idea that, and what role does the sesh have in? So sorry, talk a little bit more.
Well, I mean, I think like it's our generation's version of owl men who can only express emotion through sentimental songs.
Right.
After a feed of pints.
Yeah.
You know, which is. The only way, I suppose, to write a play about your interiority without being mortified, because that's dangerously unmasculine, is if you're writing about like what it's like to be you, when the world is doing something to you in the form of a couple of lines, or do you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's very interesting. I just really like, you're a really deep thinker about these things, and it's poking me in a really nice way, like yeah, because it is so fundamental to it. And I mean, do you think about that? Because it's something that, it's funny that you say that, because I, and again, this isn't a judgment on anyone else's writing, but when I write, I like, alcohol and drugs are something that feel like, to me, inherently untheatrical to the way my brain works. Because yeah, which is interesting, but I think that more maybe goes to, which is funny, because like I'm not a drug person, but I love a pint as much as the next person. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But there's always some, like, I'm much more interested, like, the bigger moment for me, if I'm thinking of, you know, wanting to like maximize the stakes of this play, you know, it's got it for me. I'm always like, well, it's a sober thing. It actually wouldn't even come into my zeitgeist that it's a drunk thing, because it as you said, that's like an outside influence that is in turn influencing the insides, if that makes sense. So just really interesting. It's really interesting to hear you.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how far you want to spin off on this. But there's maybe a really interesting distinction there between action and ritual. Because mm-hmm. action is where something happens and you can't go back. Whereas ritual is something you can repeat and it'll mean something new every time. Mm. And those are both valid ways of making art. And I think it's really interesting, because I would agree with you on your suspicion about alcohol. Because I think alcohol's a ritual, you know, it's a thing we do. We go to a place and fundamentally nothing much changes, but it's an occasion to feel something, in the sense that you go, you sit with a bunch of people, you have a chat about something. There is a journey, even if you don't go anywhere. So that's ritualistic. Versus, I think, maybe the more well-made play, you know, kind of UK model, is that something has to happen and it has to be irreversible. And maybe that's sometimes why sesh plays are easy to denigrate, or maybe that's why you feel like alcohol, it's ritualistic rather than action based, you know, because a lot can happen on a night out, but fundamentally it doesn't change very much. Whereas it sounds like maybe you're more interested in telling stories where something happens irreversibly.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. Gosh, that's going to stick with me for a while. I'm going to be thinking about it on the bus. Yeah.
And like on a really, really stupid like level, which is, it's when you take the drugs, you make the bad choices, which is always good for drama.
Absolutely.
But in a way, because it's cheap, it's unearned. So it's much more interesting to have someone make a bad choice from something a little deeper.
Sure.
Than impaired judgment.
Yeah, I think that rings quite true to me. But again, so many of my favourite plays are the sesh play.
Yeah.
That's the thing. There's no judgment on it in any level. But it's always interesting for me. Like the work that I make doesn't even necessarily look like the work I admire.
Yeah.
Which is funny.
Yeah. No, I mean, because again, really no judgment intended there. Like, because I mean, the obvious example is Dublin Old School, which like I love so much. Like, it gave me one of my very few crises of, you know, artistic confidence, where I just went to see it for the first time, I think in 2014, and went, oh, well, fuck, art's over. You know, it's like, just give up.
They
it's
won.
Done now. Yeah, they've won. Because I was post Boys and Girls at that point, and I was trying to write another rhymey show. And then Long Run, it was really good for me, because I had to just go, cool, I can't do that. Because I'll just write my version of Dublin Old School and it won't work. I have to do something different. And then I did. And I think sometimes it's good to get those. But like with anything, it's really interesting to look at the reasons people feel drawn to revisit a genre. And to do it well or to do it badly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We give it a spin?
Ah, yeah.
Let's do it.
Having fixed masculinity and drama.
I think we completed it. Number three, do you have it?
I don't.
No worries. Number three. This is a tough question, but here we go. Who is one person who's particularly helped you along in your career?
Ooh. One person. I'm going to say the most recent one, who I suppose has been in my head a lot, because there's so many people who've been really helpful. But just because I had to revisit the help they offered, which is Madeleine Boughton, who's currently with Creative Ireland. And I think when we had just done Boys and Girls, was with Culture Ireland. But she's brilliant, like super intelligent woman, really kind, like so interesting to talk to about the art and the things that we all do. And just because there's a, I suppose there's a thought, it was the right help at the right time, in the sense that I had done a fringe show and it had gone better than I had any right to expect. And I didn't know what to do next. And it seemed like everybody wanted the second show, but nobody wanted to make it with me. And nobody wanted to tell me how to write an application. And again, I imagine there's probably some people listening to that who'll be like, oh, you could have asked me, or like, I made the offer. And I'm conscious that there's like bloke stuff tied up in the fact that I'm not very good at asking for help, unless I know I'm supposed to or allowed to. But Madeleine was really proactive about just saying, if you want to sit down and talk about where you can tour this show and what you need to do in order to make that happen, let's meet. And we did. And I think it was off the back of that, the boys and girls ended up going to New York and then possibly Moscow. Although then there was a huge amount of help there from Matt Smith, who is another person. See, this is the problem. You can't credit with one person without having to...
Totally.
Because, you know, everything, like, it's a collaborative art form. It always emerges from a... takes a village to make a play.
I think that was in my head too.
Yeah. But I suppose just, I think on that because I think like I was saying earlier about, you know, waiting for your administrative skills to catch up with your sensibility. I think not dissimilarly, there's a dangerous thing can happen where you do one good thing and then and then your reward for doing one good thing is you're not allowed to do that again. You know, because you're immediately catapulted to, you have to make something bigger and you don't know how to do that. Like Difficult second album. But you're always making your difficult second album because the price of success is having to do something new. Mm. And that's scary, you know, if you're not embedded in a community of like mentors and more experienced people who can talk you through that and help you along that that arc. And I try to do that for, you know, kind of younger theatre makers I work with or know or who I feel are struggling a little bit. And I just know now that I'm starting to do it, that like you're so happy to. And the only time you're not happy to is when you feel like someone just takes it for granted because obviously you exist for their benefit. You know, it's like, well, of course you'd offer me that help. And you're like, no, no. The thing I'll never say, but I'm thinking, is that you're not special. I'm just nice. And I suppose just I had that happen a little bit recently where like I was helping someone with college monologues and then they just disappeared and never told me they'd gotten in somewhere, which is hurtful because, you know, you're invested in them. You give a shit about them and... you know, it's as close to parenting as I'm likely to to get
right.
The economy. And then I suppose I was just thinking, I was like, oh God, I really hope I thanked Madeleine properly. So I said it to her recently and she was like, ah, look. But you know, in that way where you want to have been as grateful as you felt, even if you are not very good always at saying what you mean, because it can feel embarrassing.
Uh-huh.
That makes sense?
It does, yeah. Yeah, it's something, yeah, I really try and like that. It's funny, I said a sentence recently where I was like, to a friend, I was like, I'm tired of being vulnerable. I said that. Because I like, it's something that I strive for. And I'm, it's not really for me to say whether I'm successful at it or not, but like to try and say things in the most simple, vulnerable way possible. Because for me, that's the most authentic way I can communicate, you know, within reason. Like there's a time and a place for these things, but it's hard when you feel like you're extending that hand and it's just not being met.
Yeah. And actually, there's a really interesting thing there about, I mean, it sounds like you're having your own version of maybe, you know, coming out stress, in the sense of actually you don't owe everybody you meet the full truth about yourself. If today that feels a little bit too, or sorry, not even coming out specifically, but more broadly disclosure. Mm. Actually, you don't have to tell everybody everything about yourself because that's an uneven ask. Mm. It's harder for you, you know?
Yeah. And it sets up like an unfair expectation that that's what I feel I deserve from them, because otherwise we're not this isn't fair. You're not meeting me where I'm meeting you, but like that's enforcing my own moral compass onto them, which I have absolutely no right to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes like the simplest level is, you know, people who get really hung up on the whole how are you question, and they go, you're not really asking, and you go, yeah, but like you also don't want me to really ask because how impossible would it be to get everything done if like every time you got asked how are you, you really told people.
Right.
Everybody's on a journey. There's a lot going on, you know.
Yeah.
Lies are really handy. Polite lies are really handy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. You said they're kind of tongue in cheek about parenting, and it's as likely as I'll ever be to parent in the current economic climate.
Yeah.
Is parenting something that you think about, and having kids something that you think about in just in life, and is the economic climate like a thought that comes at the exact same time?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, I mean, like, it doesn't help that like my parents settled down with like unreasonable success really early. So I think Veronica and Kieran were married when Veronica was 21, Kieran was 25, 26, and my ma had me when she was 26. So the having a kid by the age your parents were when they had you, ship, you know, sailed, you know, yeah, kind of about 18 months ago. And like I love children, you know, which is I think I'd really like to be a dad, but several things are going to have to change pretty fucking majorly if that's ever to happen.
Yeah. Which is so, it's so good. Something I've been thinking of as well is just like, you know, what I want my life to look like, you know, and yeah, obviously like families are and aren't a huge part of that, depending on what way, what choices you want to make. But I know fundamentally as well, I'd really like to be a dad and you know, like have a child with someone if that, you know, is the right thing. But it is, it's huge. And maybe I'm a step behind you in my thought process, because I'm at the kind of point of thinking where it's like, well, I would like to be a dad and I would like to wheel a buggy, but I'm not thinking about like, how do I afford the buggy? Mm. And like, where does the child and the buggy go when I have to work or my partner has to work, and these things like the childcare, all this stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know necessarily that just because I get anxious about money as soon as I start thinking about kids means I'm necessarily more mature, because I think maybe the more mature thing would be to embrace that and find a way of making it work, or, you know, take some money job vaguely related to what I do. Whereas, but I don't know. Yeah. To me, they're very much just tied up in my head, because I think, yeah, I don't know.
But the removing the financial side from it for a moment, like the idea of like having kids and that love of children that you spoke about, like that is something that would interest you.
Absolutely. But I mean, again, I've just read some very interesting things recently, I suppose, about how weirdly men these days are the ones who are more likely to express, you know, kind of a longing for domesticity, or a nostalgia for like an imagined domesticity that we feel we're missing out on. Mm. Possibly because it's still a very uneven ask. So I mean, like Carla, my partner, works in arts admin and producing and marketing. I never know how to describe what she does, because she does so many things, and yeah, she's fucking brilliant at all of them. And you know, it's just a thing of, it's like, you know, if we were to have a child, it's a very uneven ask, you know, in the sense of, I mean, my work is very compatible with staying home and this, that and the other. None of her work is very compatible with like fucking pregnancy or what have you. And that's assuming everything goes well, which it doesn't always.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
a whole fucking minefield.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a less complex longing for us.
Mm.
Unless you resent that inclusion in that cozy conspiratorial, no, thing of us blokes.
No, not at all. I'm actually really interested. It's not something I thought about, but I mean, that does make sense. Even like, I mean, on the very basic fundamental thing of like, we don't carry, you know, life in us, and it doesn't affect our, like our body, you know, in like, yeah, the fact like we, you know, morning sickness, and like we have to literally go through like a talk about trauma. Like, it was funny, Lauren Larkin was just on the,
oh, yeah,
the chat earlier, and
who is a parent.
We spoke a lot about it, which like was weird. I caught myself as like, God, we're talking a lot about that, but I was like, I am interested, and she was interested in talking about it. It's a really interesting thing, but it's not even. And I mean, you'd like to think that, you know, in your relationship, like certainly me as a man who would like to have a child with a woman, you know, you would do your best to even that out as much, oh, yeah, as you could, even above and beyond social expectations. But yeah, I think it's such a deeply entrenched imbalance.
Oh, but like the expectations just are so like comically mismatched that I think even if you were to, going back to the trauma thing of it's, you know, which is you can only drift so far from your norm before you start to feel a little extreme. And I think in that sense, which is, you know, like the bar for dads is very low. Like I have a friend who's very cynical, having had a child, and their whole thing is like, the bar for mothers is do everything perfectly. The bar for fathers is don't fuck your children, which is like not entirely fair. Like the bar is a little bit higher than that, but like, but I mean, she's getting at something when she says that, you know, which is it's a thing of it's, you know, kind of, I see just like, you know, like parenting as an extreme form of, you know, like emotional labor for men generally, in the sense that you do a very little and you get praised to the fucking skies, do you know, mm-hmm. for being barely adequate. And I just think, however above and beyond the call of duty you feel you're going, it's probably not far enough.
Yeah, 100%. You know? I bet you're right. Right, let's give another
spin. Yeah, here we go.
Okay, number 28. Do you have it?
I don't. One off.
Ooh, number 28. The question is, do you believe in love at first sight?
Yeah. Kind of despite myself. Kind of because like to do like a proof from the converse thing of I think disbelief in it is sometimes rooted in the idea that you have to know someone wholly to love them. And you never do. So in a sense, loving someone at first sight is negligibly less arbitrary than loving them when you know them kind of well.
Mm. That's so no one's ever come at that from that point of view before.
Well, I mean, it's just, I mean, I was really struck. I read this fucking bonkers Twitter thread recently from a woman who said she just moved in with her partner. And right after she'd moved into his flat, he said something like, sometimes I wish you were just a nurse or a teacher instead of an academic, because then you'd be less threatening or intimidating. And she was ashamed because she felt tricked into being in a relationship with him for, I think, like 6 years. And I just thought that was a really interesting, complex thing in terms of it's like someone says one thing and you realize, oh, I was never in a relationship with the person I thought I was in a relationship with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, totally. Well, yeah, and I think like that's so true. For I think that's one of the really, it can be one of the puzzling things about anything. Like, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I think infidelity can be so hard, because I think fundamentally most of us are, like, I'm single right now, but if I'm to get into a relationship with someone, I'm only going to get into a relationship with someone who I think won't be unfaithful on some level. I don't think I'm going to think about it that tangibly. And if, you know, if those things arise, that I'm going to be with someone who's, you know, emotionally articulate enough to go like, oh, hang on, like there's something going on here where I like feel the need to like have an affair or to go off with someone else. Like, I think that's the best thing you could do in that scenario. So I think that's one of the things why, like, well, like, okay, there's like, there's loads of stuff tied up in like infidelity, like, again, going back to like just the masculine thing of like, there's something very shaming about that on a societal level. I think there's like, there's just a hurt thing of like, I thought we had something.
Yeah.
But then it's like, I also thought you weren't the person who would do that. I also thought you were the person who wouldn't, who liked me enough not to do that. I also thought you were the person who would never want to hurt me in the way that you've hurt me. And I mean, there's so many different versions of that. That was just the first one that came to mind. But yeah, that way that like literally our whole lives can be recontextualized. I mean, like that version is fascinating because it was probably like about three or four, a combination of three or four words. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That while they're like, they're highly problematic and like, I mean, there's so many things you could talk about what's wrong with them. But in the greater context of life, you know, it's mad that something like that, like just someone's kind of, I mean, like sexism, misogyny, whatever it is, like it comes out in like four words and you're like, wait, I didn't really know you because I didn't know you were capable of that thought.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it was really interesting because that person went on to reflect, as far as I remember, that they're saying there was such a temptation to swallow it and pretend it hadn't been said. But instead, she still had her old lease. So she just went back and she went, no, fuck it. We're done. We've just moved in. Let's unmove in.
Wow.
I'm refusing to be with this person I've never met before.
Well, I really want to hear his like when his mate, like, you know, when he, you know, the week before, he's like to his mates, yeah, you know, like me and Marion, we're moving in together. And then the next week, yeah, me and Marion are done. Like, I thought you were moving in together. Yeah, we did. But then, you know,
yeah,
said this thing. And, you know, obviously it's a terrible thing, but it's just, it, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's an amazing example.
No, and actually that thing about infidelity, I suppose, is like a thing that, you know, as a baseline level of thing and an anxiety. And I was chatting to this playwright in the UK a little while ago, and we did workshops together, Somalia Seaton. And she, you know, she coined a name for a genre, or like was kind of complaining about a genre of play that you never think of as a genre, but totally is a genre. She's like, I just feel like I'm totally done with seeing plays which are about white people cheating on each other. And I went, oh yeah, fair. You know, like rich white people cheating on each other, I think specifically was the thing. And a good little chat about, you know, like, why is that a play we keep coming back to? And I think they're saying it's like, okay, so infidelity is immediately high stakes because we can relate to it. But beyond that, I think because it's a really good concrete version, or concrete, like, I suppose, actionable version of that experience that cuts through all of life, which is the moment where it's brought home to you how partial your knowledge of someone you love very deeply is. And it's absolutely cool that we should keep thinking that thought, because there's always more to be said about it, but that maybe we should look a little further than, why are you having sex with somebody else? Because actually it's not about that.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah, it's it's a really interesting thing. You kind of illuminated it within me earlier on in the chat, where I was talking, we were talking about, you know, it was around the vulnerability thing and how much you reveal, how quickly you reveal it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of the things being single now, and I'd be really open to a relationship. I quite like to be in a relationship with someone if I, you know, find someone who I like and they like me. And we were, one of the things I was talking about a friend is like, is how to, like, on like, if you're dating, or like on a first date, or second, third date, whatever it might be, I would consider myself quite open and quite not an open book, because I'm sure none of us are, but I don't really, I used to have an awful lot of shame about things that weren't, like, that shouldn't have been shameful, you know what I mean, that was just kind of who I am as a person. Like, I remember having this thought at a really young age of watching something on telly, like Big Brother, which were never even things I watched, but I remember being like, I think it was just something of the fact that the cameras were always on, and like you were kind of forced to see, you know, the real people, or certainly an image that they're trying to project of who the real people are. And I remember having this thought when I was young, being like, I'd love to go on that show when my mom and dad are dead.
Wow.
Because the idea of them knowing me in that way, maybe it was even that there might be a girl sleeping in a bed beside me or something. That was so much for me.
That's so interesting you say that, because on a set of workshops with like this well-respected English playwright, who, in light of the story I'm about to tell, I feel I shouldn't name, he was talking about his shit, and he was saying, in a therapy session, you know, like that moment you expect to have but never have, where your therapist just says something and a whole little myth in your head just crumbles away and then you're free of it? Well, he said he had one of those, because he said, like, I just feel like I'm never going to get to be my authentic self until my parents die. And there was a whole lot of queer shit and everything tied up in that. And his therapist just said, but it sounds like you think that because you think you are the person your parents think you are, or you're really invested in being the person your parents think you are, but you don't have to be, and you aren't, and on some level they know that. And he went, oh right, yeah. And he's just put it down and never picked it back up.
Really?
And I was really fascinated by that, because it's just, I suppose, such a simple thought, but it's so hard to feel it as true.
Yeah.
Rather than just, it's not your fault from Goodwill Hunting moment. Like, I know. But you have to say it like 20 times before you can cry.
Totally.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's so funny. But it's that whole thing of, you know, like, you know, it took me a long, and I'm sure there's a journey to go with it still, but like to even be a fraction of my authentic self with my parents and not live up to, you know, who they want me to be. And I'm very lucky. I think my parents, you know, love me in so many ways. But it's like, it's that thing of, you know, when you're getting into, you know, something new, when you're meeting someone new for the first time, of how much to reveal, how quickly. And for me, who's someone quite comfortable with a lot of that, and like, it's done work on being comfortable within that, like, how much
Yeah.
That's okay to show quickly.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Did you see Infinity in Fringe?
I didn't, and I'm ashamed of myself.
So, I mean, I was chatting to Nessa about how much I like that show. And, you know, Veronica, my mother, is a clown. And clown is very much about vulnerability and process. And I was just saying, I felt Infinity was a beautiful illustration of the difference between telling people a lot about yourself and intimacy. Because they're not actually the same thing. Because actually there's like a beautifully packaged version of our pain we can present people with that leaves us feeling in control, which is in fact the opposite of real vulnerability or intimacy. And I thought Infinity was really striking because of how little Nessa actually told us about herself, but how beautifully intimate and vulnerable that performance was, because she stood on a stage and went through something in front of us. And I really related to that in a sense, because actually I don't talk a huge amount to my parents about like my love life or sex life or whatever, not least because, you know, I've been with Carla for nearly 7 years, so it would just be really weird because they'd know exactly who I was talking about. And yet, you know, like I wrote Boys and Girls when I was 19, and I remember sitting in the first reading saying the line, I was semi-hard at most, and just seeing my dad in the audience, you know, drop his eyes in kind of embarrassment and like laughing about it with him immediately afterward. And I think the really lovely thing about my writing that way is that it's always been this hidden in plain sight thing, which is just my parents know my world includes all of these things. My parents know my world includes drugs, includes blah, 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 includes this, that and the other, without necessarily needing to know what my mileage is on them. And in that sense, I feel very lucky that I get to be a very integrated person with my parents. Not because they know a lot of facts, but because actually they just really know what I'm like and are cool with that. So when I said like I was sickeningly happy, you know, or have a sickeningly happy family, I think that's kind of what I'm talking about. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, yeah, that like that was one of the things that was really important to me to so as to not... You know, so as to not like, especially artistically, because, you know, certainly the work that I think that I need to be making, it like it just would be not good enough for me if it was not being honest. I mean, what an obvious sentence to say. But like, so the way I had to contextualize that, and I don't really have to do it so much anymore. It's become more of an automatic thought. But like even something like this podcast, I'm like, well, this isn't for mom and dad.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't for them. Yeah, and the plays I write aren't for mom and dad. Like, they can come and see them. That's fine. But they're making a decision to step into my world. And it's my world.
On your terms.
On my terms. And when I go home, I'll try my best to be a really good son and to fit into that bracket. And that's okay. Like, that's a role we play, you know?
Yeah.
And
there's a really sweet little story that way, actually, because... So skating magnificently onto thin ice and speaking about experiences very different from mine, where I have no authority. I was reading a really interesting thing a little while ago on them.us, which is Condé Nast's kind of queer coverage thing, about how there's a very particular narrative around coming out, which is quite white, because it relies on the sense of the totally integrated self as the only authentic self. And they're saying, whereas actually, no, we all play different roles in different circumstances. And it was specifically talking about that in relation to a study that found people from whose parents are first generation immigrants from a set of diasporas. I can't remember which ones exactly, but that on average, if they are queer, they get less happy after they come out to their parents, because their parents just don't know what to do with that information. Which is not to say their parents don't know. They just don't know what to do with this, I suppose, kind of all or nothing moment where you go, here's my truth. And I think particularly in cultures which are less, I suppose, emotionally demonstrative in the sense of let's all have a big cry and a big hug and everything. I suppose the expectations are so earth-shatteringly high that your parents can only let you down or hurt you or... related to that in a way, I was thinking sometimes there's a useful level of social subterfuge to being different people, and that isn't actually inauthentic. And I was struck by that recently because I was working with teenagers, and one of them was talking about how he does drag, and how he hates that his loving, supporting parents come to see him do drag because they just make him self-conscious. And he says he just starts to feel weird and gross because he's seeing, you know, himself surrounded by go-go dancers, you know, like through his parents' eyes.
Yeah.
And actually he can't relax into like the bit of filth, you know?
Yeah.
And I was really struck by that. It was like, oh no, that's too much love. That's too much integration. That's not enough room to be different people at different times, do you know? Totally. Because actually that forecloses on discovering, you know, because you're too busy playing the person you've always been. That makes sense?
It does. Yeah, it was funny. John Dennehy sat there a couple of, well, maybe a month ago, and it's a really special
episode.
Yeah,
I was chatting to them about that a little.
After
the fact, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a really beautiful episode, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was, but that was something that really struck me that John said was just about that, like, we talked about those different hats, and it was something that, like, I'm going to quote myself here, but it was something in the moment that, like, just occurred to, and it was, you know, it was contextualized through what John was saying, but for me it was that thing of, like, you know, I think we were saying, if John is the sea, it's okay that we're not the same all the time, because sometimes it's a beautiful day and, like, it's nice calm weather, and other mm-hmm. times it's like a storm and it's like choppy, but it's still the sea.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, like, that's kind of how it is. And as well then, it's so funny though to, you know, flip that on its head, and then, you know, the expectations that I have for people in my life,
yeah.
like, namely my parents, maybe would be good, because it's kind of what we're talking about, of like what you expect from them, and also to be like, you know, yeah, I guess it all comes down to expectation, but, like, something I've really had to, like, accept is, you know, that they probably will never, maybe, certainly my dad, say, like, we love each other in a very specific way, and in a way yeah. where, like, it's not very easy for that to be verbalized, and maybe I never get to experience the love in the language that I experience love, and I mean that, like, physically and verbally and emotionally, but just to kind of, it's hard, because it's very hard to remove your own expectations and maybe your own, like, emotional needs from things, but it's also kind of important for certain relationships to do that, because
yeah, and not in any feels bad sense, because to loop that background, that's kind of tragic
mm.
in the sense that tragedy is good against good,
mm.
which is that you've got two people who love each other very much, but whose terms and expressions of love just don't tessellate or something. Yeah,
yeah.
That's kind of tough.
It is, yeah. It's also so good when you can see little moments of, like, when, like, they're trying to get there, and, like, and it's an absolute failure, and it's very awkward, but, like, it's like the intention is so noble behind it, you know what I mean, like, that can kind of be enough.
Yeah, it's really funny you say that, because I think my dad is quite an, for his generation, quite an unmasculine man mm. in some ways, but then in other ways, you know, I was chatting to Carla about this recently, that, like, last year when I was living away, we were very good about staying in contact, and then we just never fell back into it this year. And that, you know, my mother's really interesting, because I tend to buy them tickets because there's not stuff they want anymore. And that if we're going to a show together, it's, you know, so that we have time to hang out, she'll always build in, you know, time for a drink or a sit down and a chat beforehand. Whereas my dad just tends to be like, okay, I'll see you there, you know, like 10 minutes before the show starts, and then we'll sit and we'll enjoy the show and then we will leave. And I just think it's interesting that somewhere in his training, you know, he forgets to build in time for the sociality that he misses, because, like, he would say sometimes that he misses hanging out with me. And I had literally just said that to Carla, and I got a text from my dad saying, do you want to meet for coffee? And when we sat down for coffee, the first thing he said was, oh yeah, I realised I was forgetting to actually be proactive about seeking you out, that, you know, if you don't live here, I have to do that. Mm. And I was just really struck by his perspective on that journey, and mm. actually the two of us maybe converging on a way of being together.
Yeah. That's lovely. That's a lovely moment.
Yeah.
Man, that's us. Thank you
so
much.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming in and doing it. I know you're super busy. Obviously City Song is the big thing. So maybe tell us a little bit about that and where we can see it.
Cool. So City Song is a play of mine that won the Verity Bargate Award 2017. So as a result of that, it's being co-produced by Soho and the Abbey. It's going to be at the Abbey on the 25th of May to June 8th. So there's two previews, I think, meaning it's opening on the 27th. It's very fancy and exciting. I don't know quite what the dates are exactly for London, but it's mid-June until July. It's very self-consciously a rip-off of Dylan Thomas's Under Milk Wood for Dublin. It's set across one day in 2015, which is why certain things that are now conspicuously present are conspicuously absent. But it's about time and family and, I suppose, the same universal human experiences being channeled through the very, very specific weirdnesses of different times in Irish culture.
Mm. Brilliant, man. Dylan Coburn Gray, thanks for coming in and talking.
There you go.
So guys, that was a phenomenal Dylan Coburn Gray playing Personality Bingo. Dylan, if you're listening, a massive thank you to you for taking the time to do it. I so appreciate you coming in and us having the chat. It was so lovely to get to know you that little bit better. And as well, go and check out Dylan's work. I mean, I listed off the plays there. A lot of them are available to buy here. And what I should say is City Song, his debut at the Abbey Theatre, is happening very soon. It's May 25th to the 8th of June. Go and check it out. What an achievement it is for a guy as young as Dylan to have a play on the Abbey stage. It's so impressive and I can't wait to see it for one. So go and check that out. I guarantee you it's going to be good because everything I've heard about Dylan's work has backed that assumption up. So I have no doubt that this is going to be another one in the locker for Dylan Coburn Gray. Go and check out my play too. It's The Belly Button Girl. It's from May 14th to the 19th at the New Theatre in Temple Bar. Tickets are on sale now, so go check them out at the website there. All the details are on my social media. You can get me on Twitter and Instagram at tmore93 and the Squad Productions page. As I said, we've got a great team. It's Romana Testaseca, Owen Lennon and Ursula McGinn. I'm so happy to have the guys on board and we're having a great time doing it. So come and check us out. I think you'll really like the play. I'll be frank about it. I'm really proud of it. And I'd love to pack it out for the week. So come and see us. And as well, get in to see Copperface Jackson Musical. Lads, it might sound a bit bizarre. It mightn't sound up your street. But I guarantee you, it's a great night. The only reason it's coming back is because audiences loved it. We managed to pack the Olympia out last summer. And we'd love to do the same this year. I'd love for you to see it. It's a load of fun. It's got lovely heart to it too. And gosh, I couldn't be lucky enough to be working with a better bunch of people. So, enough of all that. Let's thank the boss woman, Erin Lindsay, for mixing, editing and producing this podcast. To the wonderful Connor Nolan for his gorgeous artwork. To Leah Moore and Anthony Manley for their beautiful theme music. And to Alan Bennett and Paddy O'Leary for keeping the lights on here at Headstuff HQ and having us aboard the team. Go check out some of the other podcasts on Headstuff. And as I said, chip something into our Patreon. That's patreon.com/personalitybingo. It means the world if you can do it, and I will be forever in your debt. Lads, we'll see you back here next week for another episode of Personality Bingo with Tom Moran. Tom Moran's Personality Bingo.